Hello and welcome to another Little Atoms Road Trip podcast. I'm your host Neil Denny. I'm in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, and earlier today I went to visit Dr. Stephen Barrett. Dr. Stephen Barrett is a retired psychiatrist who has achieved national renown as an author, editor, and consumer advocate. An expert in medical communications, Dr. Barrett operates Quack Watch, Autism Watch, and other websites, and edits Consumer Health Digest, a free weekly electronic newsletter. He has written thousands of articles and delivered many talks at colleges, universities, medical schools, and professional meetings. His 50 books include The Health Robbers, A Close Look at Quackery in America, and 7 editions of the college textbook Consumer Health, A Guide to Intelligent Decisions. He received the 2001 Distinguished Service to Health Education Award from the American Association for Health Education, and he's made many media appearances, including Dateline, The Today Show, Good Morning America, ABC Primetime, CNN, and National Public Radio. I'm sitting in the office of Dr. Stephen Barrett. So, Stephen, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you.
Particularly interested on this trip to look at the contrasts between the UK and the US in terms of science and rationalism and scepticism and things. I've looked at some things already, like creationism, which are things that are perhaps more particular to the US and are only just starting to encroach in the UK. Today we're going to talk about alternative medicine and quackery, which are things that we're, you know, we also have to have a lot of dealings with in the UK. So over the course of the interview, we'll perhaps look at some of the contrasts. But let's talk about your background first. How did you get into this?
I got into this quite by accident. I am a psychiatrist. I went to medical school. In the late 1960s, I read a few books that got me upset. One was about chiropractors, and the other one was about the government struggle against quack medicines around the turn of the 20th century. So I had no particular outlet for my upset, but I became sensitized to the issue. Later, when we moved to the East Coast, we noticed that the water wasn't fluoridated where we lived, and there were some very strange chiropractic ads in the newspaper. My wife said, "Why don't you do something about it?" And so I formed a discussion group. Eventually, about 40 people joined, and we met every other week for about 5 years. Began talking about some of these issues, and it turned out there were a lot of people with other concerns in the area of health. So we began communicating, and as a result, a whole nationwide network of interested people began to form, and eventually a national organization arose.
So you maintain a number of websites, but the main one, the one that most people will be familiar with, is Quack Watch. That's the one that's the sort of mothership of all of the other websites. So when did you start Quack Watch?
I got on the internet at the end of 1996, thinking that I would just put up some articles to enrich the course for students who were using my college textbook. I have a college textbook called Consumer Health that was in use in probably about 100 colleges in health education. So when I got on the internet, I discovered that there's a lot more you can do. Of course, this was before Google, mm-hmm. and before it was possible to get enormous amounts of information instantaneously. As the internet developed, I felt like a kid that had suddenly gone into a room full of ice cream. You know, oh my God, all this stuff out there. And I just love to collect information, sort it, put it in perspective. And I've been doing it for more than 40 years. I've collected a lot of things in print before the internet, and I save them. And I have tons and tons of documents in my, I mean literally tons of documents in my files, so that I can go back and look at the history of many of the things that we see today.
And the internet has made contact between people that share this same interest so much easier. And organisations, for instance, the Skeptics in the Pub movement have come on in leaps and bounds since the internet. I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now because I wouldn't have a podcast if it wasn't for the internet. But of course, it works the other way as well, doesn't it? It means that the internet has helped the people that you argue with to disseminate their ideas easier as well.
Well, what I say is that people ask me, is there more quackery today than there used to be? And I say, probably. Has the internet made it easier to spread? Yes. However, just because you put something up doesn't mean that someone else is going to see it. There's a lot of competition for attention. But what the internet does is it enables people to put lots more information much more efficiently and inexpensively.
I want to perhaps set the scene as to when you started getting concerned about quackery and the point where you started the QuackWatch website. What was the sort of general situation like here in the US, and what was the appetite for this sort of thing?
The timing of what I did had more to do with me than the United States. What happened was in the 1970s, I did some undercover investigations and found that the news media were not interested. I showed, for example, that a chiropractic leader had lied to Congress as part of the lead-up to Medicare. And I decided that if I wanted to tell the story of what I was looking at, I would have to tell it myself. And so I wasn't a writer, and I didn't like to write, but I'm a good organizer. So I got about 30 people together. Each one promised a chapter, and worked for 3 years and produced my first book, which is The Health Robbers. From that point on, I began to take more of an interest in writing. My publisher encouraged me to do more, and so I began doing many, many, many books. Meanwhile, the people who had, we kept track of who had contacted me and was able to use that list to start the National Council Against Health Fraud to contact people all over the country.
So I wanted to talk a bit more about the National Council for Health Fraud. So this is sort of an organization that you co-founded. So tell us a little bit more about that.
The National Council, at its peak, had about 1,000 members and had committees and did position papers and met regularly, formed a network that the leaders could communicate. And it functioned, I would say, mightily for about 20 years. Had a media clearinghouse, had a very prominent role because reporters knew how to find it, and so the people who were knowledgeable would be quoted quite often. I averaged about 10 interviews a week for a very long period of time. The council became inactive in about 2002 and actually got dissolved, I guess it was last year, because the internet really made it unnecessary. We found that instead of, for example, publishing a newspaper, I started a free newsletter that pretty much covered the same ground. And so there really wasn't a market for a membership organization, at least that we could see.
And your website has a huge archive of articles and, you know, a glossary of terms. So I think we should perhaps, now, you know, we've raised the term health fraud as well, as I've said quackery a few times, perhaps we should perhaps have done this at the start, but let's define what you actually mean by those things. So what sort of thing comes under the rubric of quackery for you? What sort of things do you look at?
Now, I think of quackery as overclaim in the field of health. And generally, it involves pseudoscientific claims, not just gross falsehoods. But there is overlap. Of course, there are many people who make scientific claims who also habitually lie in order to try to defend themselves. QuackWatch is actually a network now of 25 sites. And the reason there are so many is that I like indexes where people can look down the list and see what's inside. And so as the list got too long, I broke off topics and made each one a different website. Mm-hmm. People can go to websites and search, but if you're in the area of quackery, you may not know what to look for. So I try to put as many as possible, and we probably have, maybe 300-400 different topics indexed on the various sites.
So who is the website aimed at primarily?
I would say the website's aimed at pretty much anybody. There are the average consumer who wants information. It's useful to legislators. It's useful to attorneys who are considering filing lawsuits. It's useful to educators, students, insurance companies. We've had feedback from just about every nook and cranny of the marketplace.
Before we actually look at some examples, talk again about what the sort of the appetite for that sort of thing in the US, and specifically, Why do you think people are attracted to pseudoscientific things?
People have always been interested in magic and magical promises, and there are other people who are interested in making them and for their own psychological benefit or financial benefit. And in the United States, we have a tremendous amount of freedom, and Congress has been very reluctant to curtail speech of any kind. Mm-hmm. There are limits on commercial speech, but the agencies can't keep up with the people that break the laws. The laws are fairly strong, but not necessarily tightly enforced. Sometimes they are. It depends. The problem is that there are so many lawbreakers that they vastly exceed the amount of regulation that's available.
What sort of legal framework are we talking about? Because as you said, there's obviously a strong emphasis on freedom of speech and things like that. But there are there consumer protection laws, for instance?
We have pretty powerful laws. We have laws against false advertising. We have laws against improper labeling. Laws that regulate drugs say that if you market a drug, it has to be demonstrated to be safe and effective and have adequate directions for use. Unfortunately, the number of people doing it illegally is greater than what the FDA can manage. And the FDA procedures for example, dietary supplements are quite cumbersome. Mm-hmm. They can send out warning letters. They can make seizures, but they can't seize 50,000 products. So the internet is really like a Wild West show. It's really quite wide open. If you make claims for vaccines, that your product is a vaccine when it isn't, the FDA will give that high priority. And they give fairly high priority to some of the more outrageous claims like cancer cures. So what happens is that just about every product is marketed to boost your immune system with the thought that the hope that people will think that that's going to help them with cancer, which of course it doesn't.
So let's look at some of the targets that you tackle then. And you've already started to raise it, but the first one that's a particular concern of yours is nutritionists and vitamin pill salesmen and things like that.
Well, probably about half the people in the United States take dietary supplements. The simple things like vitamin D and folic acid, B12 for vegetarians, some of them are pretty simple and clear-cut and useful. A lot of people need to take calcium. Mm-hmm. When you get beyond some of the essential nutrients, almost nothing is useful. Some exceptions. There are some people who might benefit from fish oils, and I don't have the list memorized. We do have an article on Quackwatch called Rational Use of or Appropriate Use of Dietary Supplements. But when you get into claims for disease prevention and disease treatment, almost nothing is useful. Some things have been considered promising, but when appropriate tests have been done, almost nothing turns out to be useful. For example, antioxidants looked 30 years ago like they might be useful in preventing cancer and heart disease, but it turns out that eating the foods seems to be useful, but taking isolated nutrients has not turned out to be useful for almost every test that's been done. The one exception is for an eye condition where it's still being studied. Whether it's going to turn out to be useful or not, I don't know.
A lot of the things that we're talking about here, as you said, sort of antioxidants and you know, vitamin supplements that don't necessarily have the effect that might be claimed for them, are quite benign, I guess. Let's talk about some areas where these people, the nutritionists and vitamin pill sales people, are doing something that could be considered more harmful.
Well, actually, what you call benign is to me more concerning because it affects vastly greater numbers of people. It generates very large amounts of money, and the money is to some extent used to corrupt our government. There have been situations where a few legislators have lost elections because they did something that displeased the vitamin industry, which then ran a campaign of lies to get them not elected again. The money has also generated weakening of some of the laws and so on. But okay, so I will go into the more serious ones are less often because you don't really want to be killing your clients. But what you have is many systems are offered as cures for just about everything there is. The greater you can get somebody to believe or the more desperate they are, the more you can charge and still get away with it. A few people get done in by taking overdoses, but the vast majority are simply economic victims. And the economic victimization with, say, dietary supplements is not just economic. When you take something and you think it makes you feel better and it doesn't, you sustain mental damage. And why is that important? Because later on you may have to decide who to believe or where to go and when you have a serious illness. And if you've developed a trust in, let's say, people selling vitamins or people offering vitamin treatment, you may decide to go in that direction rather than standard and appropriate medical care. So economic damage is not pure economic damage. It can also change people's belief systems. I mean, the same process.
Have you actually crossed swords with any of the people that are the sort of, you know, the real outliers, the people that are doing really damaging? Like, I'm thinking of, you know, the obvious example is selling vitamin C as a cure for AIDS, for instance.
There aren't a lot of phony AIDS cures around anymore. AIDS has been sufficiently well studied and treated that AIDS quackery is relatively rare. People know that they can get good treatment now. 15 years ago, it was an entirely different story. It was rampant, but it's really amazingly decreased. Cancer quackery is alive and well. You have the Mexican clinics, and it's not easy to do it in the United States. Government has gotten pretty tough, and I think the people who are inclined to do quack things are not inclined to do them in the United States. If they have a license, it's pretty high risk, because you do it once and somebody complains and you may lose your license. So they tend to go to Mexico. Some of them have clinics in the Caribbean. They fly patients down, or patients fly down, and so on. The bigger one is, in the outrageous department in the United States, is chelation therapy. That's the giving of an intravenous solution that supposedly pulls heavy metals out of your system and will cure heart disease, cancer, autism, and so on. Chelation is by far the most serious form of quackery that's widespread in the United States.
So on what scale is that going on?
Well, the government did a survey in 2007. They found that about 180,000 people got chelated that year, including 70,000 children. Now, why would anybody want to chelate a child? You know, maybe 50 had lead poisoning, and all the rest, or almost all the rest, were basically quack treatments for autism, behavioral disorders, and so on. It's a terrible thing.
But those 50 that had lead poisoning, this is still, you know, this
I don't
is still
even
not...
I don't even know if there were 50. There was a survey done that found that the number of people chelated who had lead poisoning was something in the order of, you know, 1,000 or less. And so what are the rest getting it for? Probably adults with heart disease and children with autism.
But let's just establish this is also not a legitimate cure for lead poisoning.
Now, chelation therapy has a small application to severe cases of lead poisoning. It's not used as much as some of the other drugs anymore, but it is appropriate. It's not done the same way. The protocol is different for treating lead poisoning and for the quack form of chelation therapy.
You raised the condition of autism there as one of the possible reasons why this treatment might be used, and this is one of the areas I wanted to move on to. So first of all, let's look at perhaps the strange antipathy towards vaccines in the area of autism, first of all.
The two are tied together, which is one of the reasons why I find the chelationists to be very dangerous, because they're basically at the center of the anti-vaccination movement, because they're saying to people, vaccines are toxic and you should avoid them or change the schedule depending on your level of belief.
To what extent do you think that's, I mean, how widespread is that? How widespread is that? Are we reaching the point where so many people are not having the vaccinations that it becomes a problem?
Well, in the United Kingdom, I think that the Wakefield scandal caused a significant drop that's been well studied and reported. In the United States, it's sporadic. There are some communities where there's been a sharp drop where the community no longer has what's called herd immunity or herd protection. When you reach a certain level, it's very hard for the virus to spread. When you get below that, it can spread, and that's dangerous because vaccines are not 100% protective, number one. And number two, there's a period of time where the child may be too young, might still be exposed. Some pediatricians, for example, are concerned that if an infected person comes into their office and is near young children that have not been vaccinated, those kids will be at risk. And so there are some pediatricians that are saying, you don't vaccinate, you go somewhere else.
What do you think motivates that? I mean, are we talking about people just being disbelieving in the science, or is this almost like a sort of traditional American anti-government thing, you know, a sort of like reluctance to allow the government to interfere in people's lives?
I think it's all of those things and more. What happens when you attempt to, let's say, change someone's behavior is you might just throw out 5 or 6 arguments, or in the case of fluoridation, there are probably 750 arguments. Only one has to catch, and that's enough. With autism, what you have is organization through the internet, because you have a lot of people who feel desperate, a lot of people who feel guilty, who would be relieved to think that it wasn't their fault. They can external, of course, nobody knows what causes autism, and it's nothing for parents to be guilty about. But nevertheless, there are many parents, it's a natural thing, I think, to wonder whether there's anything you could have done to prevent it. And then you you go online to find out if there's something you can do, and you're exposed to people with very deep beliefs that vaccine did it to their kids, and they say that, oh, we had chelation and now they're fine. And, you know, most of these people are liars. Their kids are not fine, but they'll say they're fine. And so there are basically a whole bunch of autism cults, I suppose you could say, that are organized around discussion lists, and so much so that some of them won't even allow criticism. You post a contrary message in some of these groups and you're out of the group.
I'd like to spend some time looking at chiropractic, which is, as you mentioned at the top of the interview, one of the things that first got you interested in this area. In the past few years in the UK, I'm sure you're well aware of the case. A good friend of our radio show, Simon Singh, has just spent years of his life fighting the British Chiropractic Association.
Simon Singh is one of my email friends. I, of course, was concerned about the suit that was done against him, and I sent him some information that I thought would be useful for strategy and for bolstering some of the things that he said.
So let's talk about the situation here in the US then. How widespread is chiropractic as a practice?
There are lots of chiropractors here. There are probably about 55,000, maybe 60,000. Some of them market very aggressively. Some of them set up booths in health fairs and tell everybody that they need treatment and so on. There are lots and lots of problems. They've managed to persuade state legislatures to force insurance companies to pay them. Insurance companies don't like chiropractors. They know that they have a tendency to oversell themselves. But they've gotten laws passed in at least 40 states that force insurance companies to some extent to cover them in their contracts. My primary concern about chiropractic is economic. That is, there are many, many people go to chiropractors and are told that their neck is too straight or their neck is too curved or their spine is too straight or their spine is too curved or their spine is degenerating and they should come once, twice, three times a week for 6 months, a year, 2 years, and they'll give them a 10% discount if they pay in advance. I hear from people like that almost every week when they catch on. The process of examination and adjustment has not only never been demonstrated to be useful, it's never even been studied. And no one's ever going to study it. They just made it up. That's what they do. Not all of them, but too many of them.
What you just mentioned there about the economic tactic is of course a regular tactic of alternative practitioners. It's, you know, hooking someone on and then taking payments off them for months and months for something which obviously they're never going to cure because it doesn't happen in the first place.
Nobody does it as well as chiropractors. They actually have whole textbooks. I collect them. I found out about this by starting to collect actual practice building textbooks, and I have now, many of them are now DVDs and they used to be in print, but I have, I think, four file drawers just filled with those things, courses and so on. These were not meant for public view. And I remember that I got my first one in the late 1970s. It resulted in a front page story in the New York Times on a Sunday. They thought it was so interesting, but it's still in use.
What about how popular is homeopathy in the US? It's quite a big thing in parts of Europe as well as in the UK, but how widespread is it here?
Homeopathy is not particularly popular here. I'm not sure that more than 1 or 2% of the population pays much attention to it. The people who use it tend to think very strongly, many of them think very strongly, but the number of actual practicing homeopaths is only a few hundred. But the medicines are sold and they're put out in drugstore shelves and health food store shelves as though they're effective. The FDA permits them to be sold unless they make pretty startling claims, and even if they do, they may still get away with it.
Let's have a closer look at some of those FDA rules again then, because are you campaigning to change things on that front? What could be done? What could be done to tighten up those laws, I guess, is the question.
Well, as a practical matter, there's very little that can be done to change the laws because science does not determine what Congress does. Congress has very little interest in tightening consumer protection laws. There are enough legislators in powerful positions who are very friendly with the quack community that the chances of making a change are extremely small.
And is there no particular mileage in this for other politicians to? Is it not something that they would see as a vote winner?
I don't even think they think about it. The way it works is that there's nobody who's attempting to change it, and there's not much going on to try to change it in the other direction either. A little bit doesn't get anywhere so far. I mean, the big change was in 1994 when the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act was passed. There was a backlash against one of the FDA commissioners who really wanted to do something and just got the health food industry extremely upset. And they started a campaign and generated 1 million communications to Congress and got the law weakened.
You've already raised the idea of pseudoscientific cancer treatments, but I'd like to look at that a little bit again. What other types of dodgy cancer treatments are there in the US?
Most of the so-called alternative cancer treatments are done in addition to rather than instead of, but the common ones are vitamins and vitamin and mineral combinations. I don't think that most of the others have a very large following for a number of reasons, one of which is they're very expensive. The other is that you have to travel, but the number offering products to boost your immune system is huge, and not just for cancer, but they kind of imply it's good for anything.
Obviously, the health systems are different in the UK and the US, and we fight battles to try and prevent alternative medicine being used on the NHS in the UK. I wonder if we could perhaps talk a little bit about to what extent medical practitioners, doctors, are willing to use alternative medicine. To what extent are they adopted by mainstream medical practitioners over here?
In terms of opposition, the United Kingdom is way ahead of us. In your country, it appears that a small group of prominent professors can have a lot of sway. Mm-hmm. In this country, nobody has a lot of sway. And the government is so diverse with so many jurisdictions that it's virtually impossible to get them to do anything about this. Occasionally, a powerful congressman can slip something in to promote quack things. But the other direction, there's simply no practical way to do this. You asked about medical education. Same thing. A few influential people in the United Kingdom have been able to squelch some pretty bad educational programs. Here, it doesn't work that way. There's no central force that has that power. What's happened is that Congress passed a law about 20 years ago to set up a center at the National, that became part of the National Institutes of Health, a tiny little office that had no respect, scientific respect whatsoever. Gradually, they got more money. With money, you can buy a lot of interest and respect. And so what happened is the medical centers like to get money. They're pretty needful. And so the National Center has set up little satellite centers in many of the medical schools by setting up funding. And what they study, for the most part, is legitimate. They'll study a couple of herbs, but they'll call themselves a center and they'll market themselves as offering something complementary and alternative, something or other, when actually what they offer is almost nothing. Massage, which is not outside the mainstream. Some of them offer acupuncture, which really doesn't have a lot of mainstream acceptance. None of this stuff has a lot of mainstream acceptance. It's more a matter of mainstream tolerance, where people who want to do it are just let to run loose inside medical centers because nobody wants to get involved in a nasty battle. So I would say there's a lot of tolerance. Now, there is some confusion because there are a few advocates that have gotten into positions where they're actually teaching nonsense to students. We've had complaints from students who, one in particular in a Midwestern school, tried to complain that his teacher was teaching quack things, and he was forced to make a written apology out of fear of being kicked out of the school. So I think of the National Center for Complementary Alternative Medicine as kind of a cancer within the National Institutes of Health, and they set up little satellite cancers, which I call metastases, within many of the medical schools. And there are people actually who are professors who talk about providing alternative and complementary medicine. Mostly what they do is silly stuff. Mind-body things, meditation, therapeutic touch. Occasionally they get away with pushing homeopathy as effective. Mostly they do feel-good things and they call it that, and all the rest kind of use that and say, well, this legitimizes what they do. So whether you call it mainstream acceptance or not, within education, the boundaries have become somewhat blurred. The situation is really basically disgusting, what's going on in some of the medical schools.
On that specific point, as you said, a lot of that stuff is touchy-feely, described as complementary.
They call exercise complementary medicine. It's not. But what they managed to do is to take things that were part of standard treatment and somehow that are useful and somehow say, we're the one that are doing this. They'll talk about, for example, we spend a lot of time with patients. Yeah, a lot of that time might be wasted. Or maybe they don't spend a lot of time. Homeopaths talk about how much time they spend. You know, most people who do homeopathy in this country are chiropractors. You give them a symptom, they look it up in a book, and you're out. You're out in 2 minutes. There's been an unopposed claim that the complementary and alternative practitioners spend a lot of time. No one has ever examined whether that's even true, and I don't think it is.
We know, obviously, there's the placebo effect and the fact that these things often, they do work. I'm doing inverted commas.
I'm pointing
when I say
my
that.
Fingers at you, shaped as a gun. And
none of this can be seen on the radio, obviously.
That's why I'm saying this. I hate when people say that. The placebo effect has almost nothing to do with this.
Okay.
The reason that people believe is not the placebo effect. It's the natural course of the ailment. It's that people have tendency, even with serious disease, to have ups and downs, and they go and they feel their worst, and naturally they're going to feel better because they would have felt better anyway. And that's what sells it. It's not the placebo effect. And when people say, well, the placebo effect can be useful, that drives me up a wall. That has nothing to do with this. This stuff is not useful. It's selling people on the idea that they've been helped when all that's happened is their body's natural reaction is to have periods when they feel better. The placebo effect has almost nothing to do with this.
Let's perhaps spend a little time talking about current campaigns. What's going on now? If listeners go and look at your website right now, what would be what things are you working on right at the moment?
Well, we're most concerned about chelation. I think chelation is the most serious because it involves dealing with a lot of sick people who might be deterred from getting appropriate treatment. It involves sucking in a lot of families and giving very unpleasant treatment to tens of thousands of children. So chelation is, to my mind, far worse than anything else. It's widespread, it's vicious, it's expensive, and it's confusing. Beyond that, the biggest problem you can label or describe is multi-level marketing. We have millions and millions of people buying into companies with the claim that you'll make money, and they go out and try to sell supplements. And you know, if you want to sell somebody a product that isn't any better than anybody else's, you have to say things that aren't true. So you have millions of people saying, my product will work for you. It's better than this product, better than that product. Dr. William Jarvis, the founder and longtime president of the National Council Against Health Fraud, used to say multi-level marketing is an industry where people are turned into quacks. You take ordinary people and turn them into quacks by the million. The fact is, almost nobody makes money, and the Federal Trade Commission has chosen not to look at the heart of the problem and is not adequately regulating it.
Looking at that collation problem, do you find yourself embroiled with practitioners? I mean, how do they react to the campaigns?
I'm not embroiled with anybody. I don't get embroiled. I don't pay any attention. I pay very little attention to people who disagree with me. I'm not sure that many people actually bother to disagree with me. They just go on their merry way. I am being sued by one of the companies that's part of the chelation network, and that's a bit of a nuisance, but it'll eventually get thrown out.
So does that happen a lot? I mean, how much of that is a problem? Because, again, it'd be interesting to understand that sort of legal climate, because obviously things are a lot different in the UK in terms of how easy it is to sue people.
I would say there are not a lot of lawsuits because they're expensive and they're hopeless. Very different here from the United Kingdom in that in the United Kingdom, it's frightfully more expensive and complicated to get a suit dismissed. Here, it sometimes is very, very simple.
Okay, just to finish off then, what sort of tips would you give people to stop them falling for this stuff? How are people more able to distinguish science from pseudoscience?
Well, the trick is to have the right level of skepticism, because there are some people who are told, who think, well, I've got to figure this out for myself and by reading everything. Every single person who's contacted me and said, I've been researching this and blah, 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 I've never met one who ever came out with the right answer. If you think that researching is going to get you an answer, it already means that you don't understand what you're dealing with. You should have sufficient distrust that you should seek out reliable sources, but it's also important that you develop considerable trust in reliable sources. And it's really not difficult to tell the difference if you have the right attitude. Government agencies tend to be reliable. Major professional groups tend to be reliable. Major voluntary groups in this country tend to be reliable. And we've cataloged them. We have
We have lists on QuackWatch, and we have another site called Internet Health Pilot, and we've listed over 400 reliable sources. You don't need 400 reliable sources. You can find out almost anything you want with far less. It's a good idea to have a general idea how to use the Internet. It's also helpful to have what I call your own information anchor, and that is a practitioner or publication or both who is scientifically oriented and who can help you sort things out if you have to. But you shouldn't have to do very much sorting. And for many years, I used to recommend Consumer Reports on Health newsletter as the best information anchor. I no longer do. They've crossed the line and put out a number of quack articles, which are just horrendous. I now recommend Berkeley Wellness as the best newsletter for sorting things out. I also have a couple of practical tips. I have a webpage called How to Spot a Quacky Website, but it works for books or anything else. Tip number one is people say, give us your tips. And the standard tip is, if anything seems too good to be true, don't believe it. That is such nonsense. It's not going to seem too good to be true if they've caught you. You want to know the best way, the most practical tip is don't ever take any advice from anybody who is selling vitamins, minerals, homeopathic products, or herbs. That means your doctor, your pharmacist, any website, anybody. Because nobody who sells this stuff markets it honestly and can be trusted. I figured that out logically. I mean, I've seen tens of thousands. You know why that's true? Because if you want to sell a multivitamin, there's only one way to sell it honestly, and that's to say, here's our product. It doesn't contain any more than 100% of the recommended dietary allowance, because you shouldn't ever go over that without a good medical reason. And it's cheap, because we'll sell it. You can buy ours for maybe a dollar or two a month, and it's no different. And the ones that are selling for 50 and 60 a month are no different and no better. And most people don't need multivitamins, but if you want to take it for insurance, don't take it every day, because you don't need it every day. Every 2 or 3 days is sufficient. So if you want to take vitamins for insurance, don't spend more than a dollar a month. Now, who do you think is going to give you that presentation? Who's selling this stuff? Nobody. Therefore, nobody can be trusted. A very simple, basic slice. Now, when it gets into, I mean, that's the simple thing. When you get into claims about antioxidants and so on, I mean, they're all giving lines of bull, if they say anything. So you can't market a product honestly and earn a living. So I would say, stay away from all those sources. You stay away from all those sources, you're staying away from way over 90% of all websites. Okay? Second tip, don't trust anyone who says that everyone needs to take supplements. A good lot of people can benefit. But anyone who says everyone should take it is a sloppy thinker or is overselling. So with those two tips alone, you can probably avoid the vast majority, well, the overwhelming majority of bad sources. I used to look at a book, for example. Somebody writes a book. I look in the back and I look at vitamins. I read the page on vitamins. It says everyone should take them. Bye-bye book. So I can screen. How do you evaluate a website with 5,000 pages? Would you believe? I put the word homeopathy. And if I pull up articles favoring homeopathy, that's another tip. Don't trust anyone who promotes homeopathy. So if you want to look at a very large medical website, just look for the word homeopathy. If it's promotional, it means there's something wrong with editorial judgment. And what you want to do when you look at a big website is say, how's the editor's judgment? The homeopathy tip takes 30 seconds. Perfect screening. So it doesn't leave a lot of sites. I mean, even some of the big ones. Now, at times, Medscape, for example, is not 100% reliable because, I mean, as a result of my pestering, they've gotten rid of most of their junk on homeopathy. I used to complain to the Hancode agency, the one that talks about, that awards seals for accuracy and so on. And I was relentless. I would go to Medscape every couple of months and put in homeopathy and complain. And every time they had to take them out. I haven't looked lately.
I've been talking to Dr. Stephen Barrett. Stephen, thank you very much for talking to Little Atoms today.
Thank you.
I'm Mark Abrams from the Ig Nobel Prizes. That was a Little Atoms road trip podcast. The show is produced and presented by Neil Denny. It was made possible by a traveling fellowship from the Winston Churchill Memorial Trust. Is this Winston Churchill, the former prime minister?
Certainly
or is. Winston Churchill, who supplies all the fish for a little restaurant up in the Scottish Highlands.
He doesn't have that much funds, unfortunately, that second Winston Churchill.
Okay. Well, anyway, in any event, no matter who it was, please follow Neil's adventures on his American trip as he twitters at his Twitter handle, which is @LittleAtoms. And thanks for listening.